Mothers would have the kids line up according to t-shirt color or use the shirts to form groups for activities. Then, in another version of the experiment, there were motivational posters displayed around the classroom that mainly showed kids in blue shirts in the victorious roles, winning a race, being elected class president, and so on. All the students in that experimental group were told that the posters reflected the accomplishments of kids in the prior year's program. So what happened? Perhaps not surprisingly, the kids who saw all the blue shirt motivational posters developed significant pro-blue shirt bias by the end of the experiment. But even in the version where the colors of shirts were simply pointed out in supposedly neutral ways, the kids still developed biases. They consistently assigned more positive traits to their own color group. They also essentialized each other, seeing less variation among individuals in the groups than the kids in the control class did. Kids started to think that blue was different from yellow, Bigler writes. What comes very quickly after that is, the blues are better than the yellows. Artificially created minimal groups can induce in-group bias and out-group discrimination in adults, too. In 1973, social psychologist Henri Tafel conducted a minimal group study in which groups of teenage boys were shown several paintings and then told, falsely and at random, that they had demonstrated a preference either for the art of Paul Klee or the works of Vasily Kandinsky. Then later, when they were tasked with distributing resources, the Klee lovers discriminated against the Kandinsky lovers, and vice versa, even though there was no real benefit to themselves in discriminating. The study, Teufel wrote, established social categories on an explicitly random basis without any reference to any such real similarity. It's safe to say we don't have a baked-in biological instinct to deny resources to fans of turn-of-the-century Russian artists, just like these studies and plenty of others show that we don't have biological instincts to categorize each other by skin color or ethnicity or race, let alone discriminate against people accordingly. Those categories are also made up, but they're made up by our entire society instead of just some research team. Racial justice advocate Brian Stevenson, who was one of my professors in law school, often says slavery didn't end in 1865. It evolved. In particular, says Stevenson, the narrative of racial difference, of inherent white superiority and inherent black inferiority, which justified slavery and segregation and all manners of violence past and present, has never been fully repudiated. While we passed civil rights laws, we never confronted the damage that this narrative of racial difference did and continues to do, Stevenson says. The tendency to form groups may be written into our evolutionary DNA, but the groups we actually see and give meaning to, and thus the divisions around race and other categories that we perceive, are products of the historical and cultural DNA of our nation. That means they are deeply ingrained in us, but that doesn't mean they are inherent or inevitable. We might have a natural bias to favor some groups over others, but apparently we are not natural-born racists, concludes cognitive scientist Paul Bloom in his review of the research in this area. In fact, salient though our historical and cultural in-group and out-group tendencies may be, especially around identities like race or sexuality or economic class, it's incredibly profound to realize that even these deep, societally forged and reinforced categories of hate can be overruled in a matter of minutes by a researcher saying that you're in the Kandinsky group or you're one of the Tigers. Thus, the inverse is also, thankfully, true. Even though our brutal, hateful history may prime us towards certain patterns of otherizing, we have the capacity to change. So while Arno Michaelis certainly has and takes personal responsibility for his racism, he's the product of the same biology and social conditioning as the rest of us. There's something equalizing about that, but also terrifying. Remember that Arno wasn't looking to be a white supremacist, but rather was looking for belonging and slid into explicit racism. And the fact that he could slide into racism says just as much or even more perhaps about our society's propensity for replicating racial bias and hatred than it says about Arno. Also, Arno isn't the only person who, in searching for belonging, slid into being a neo-Nazi. Angela King is now the deputy director of Life After Hate, a group of former American right-wing extremists who now counsels others on escaping hate movements. 2 decades ago, Angela was a member of a racist skinhead group and eventually went to prison for participating in an armed robbery of a Jewish-owned store. Angela tells me over the phone that as a child, she was horribly bullied, and so she became a bully to protect herself. I pretty much told myself that if I'm the one doing the bullying, no one can ever humiliate me again. From there, she became socially isolated. I didn't have people to count on, Angela says. I didn't have a solid group of friends. I didn't feel like I was accepted. Angela searched for belonging everywhere she could find it, including joining a local gang. But when she was raped, she fled and fell in with a group of Nazi skinheads. She said she wasn't looking for hate. She was looking for somewhere she could feel safe and connected. And she found it in a hate group. Angela's friend, Tony McAleer, is on the phone too, and he chimes in. It's meeting the wrong person at the wrong time in a state of vulnerability. Angela, Tony says, was looking for something to latch on to. Tony ought to know. For years, he was a recruiter for the White Aryan Resistance, and when he was recruiting young people into the movement, he didn't try to hook them with overt racist messaging, but instead by addressing their need for belonging. He sees the same strategy in ISIS today. If you look at ISIS recruiting techniques for kids in Europe, he says in an interview with Vice, it's not like they sell it on the idea of becoming an Islamic scholar. They find these kids who are almost delinquents, and they sell them on the sense of purpose and a sense of meaning that they can find through the group. Still, why not join a chess club? Or, if you're into violence, some sort of kinky, weird sex group. Does our desire to belong to some in-group have to lead to hating some out-group? No, evolutionary biologists say. Whatever groupings we define, we have the biological capacity to hate those groups or help them. We're hardwired for both. Maybe just like sex and violence sell in Hollywood, they also sell, so to speak, in anthropology museums. Because whenever I take my daughter Willa to some natural history museum or another, there are always sprawling dioramas of prehistoric humans decapitating each other or something equally brutal. But undoubtedly, off to the side, in a tiny cabinet, is a collection of the tools they worked together to fashion, and a rendering of the primitive villages they built. Even the Greek and Roman history displays seem to emphasize war and violence way more than ideas and architecture and art. Why is it that we pay more attention to the history of competition than the history of cooperation? The fact is that for hundreds of thousands of years, as we evolved from ape-like knuckle-draggers into the modern upright creatures we are today, we lived in nomadic tribes, where different members of the group took responsibility for either hunting or gathering or protecting everyone from predators. Modern groups are psychologically equivalent to the tribes of ancient history, writes biologist E.O. Wilson, and our preference for our in-group could be like an evolutionary nod of gratitude. Some experts on human evolution have tried to argue that intergroup violence was common in this early era, and thus that violence toward outgroups is also probably innate, supposedly the root of war and mass atrocities as humanity evolved. But increasingly, scientists agree that human beings are not, or at least not only, naturally inclined to be hateful and violent, and that our tendency to form groups is not necessarily correlated with any tendency toward violence. In fact, we humans also have as strong or even stronger instincts toward empathy, altruism, and cooperation with others. Having conducted an exhaustive study of the evidence about early human violence, cognitive scientist Steven Pinker concluded that human nature may embrace motives that lead to aggression, but it also embraces motives like empathy, self-control, and reason, which, under the right circumstances, can outweigh the aggressive impulses. Humans have a capacity for warfare. Nobody's denying that, anthropologist Douglas Fry says. But to make it a central part of human nature is grossly out of contact with the data. Additional evidence for this view comes from our closest biological relatives, chimpanzees. Psychologists Martin Schmelz and Sebastian Grunesson in Leipzig, Germany, trained a group of chimps to play a sharing game. On the one side of the game was a young female chimp named Tai, and Tai had a choice of 4 ropes to pull. One rope would give just Tai herself a banana pellet, one would give another chimp a pellet, and one would give them both pellets. And the last rope would allow Tai to skip her turn and instead let the other chimp choose which of the 4 ropes to pull. But here's the thing. Unbeknownst to the other chimps, the researchers had trained Tai to always pull the last rope, thus giving her turn to the other chimp. So what did the other chimps do? Fully 75% of the time, they pulled the rope to give both themselves and Tai a banana pellet. In a sense, rewarding Tai for her behavior. But the real test of cooperation came next. The team repeated the experiment, but after Tai gave up her turn, the other chimps had the option to give themselves 4 banana pellets and none to Tai, or give both themselves and Tai only 3 pellets. So giving Tai pellets would mean getting fewer pellets themselves. In a control test, the subject chimps shared the pellets just 17% of the time. But when they saw that Tai had foregone her turn and given it to them, the chimps shared the pellets 44% of the time, even though it meant they got fewer pellets themselves. This study and many others like it confirm that even our mammalian ancestors are hardwired for the sort of reciprocity that Schmeltz and Grunnison call the landmark of human cooperation. And so are we. In another study, 36 chimpanzees and 36 18-month-old humans were each placed in a room with a human stranger and some object the stranger pretended to clearly want. The object was out of reach for the stranger, but not for the chimps and the toddlers. When the stranger reached for the object but clearly couldn't get to it, the majority of chimps and toddlers would help the stranger by handing him or her the object, even if the chimps and toddlers didn't get any rewards for their kindness themselves. The only species difference found, the researchers report, was that the helping of human infants was faster. The toddlers were even quicker to altruistically help the stranger. Psychologist Franz De Waal, who has spent his entire career studying primates and comparing their behavior to human nature, argues that this sort of compassion and kindness traces back through ancient evolution, probably as old as mammals and birds. So while the desire for belonging may be part of what draws people into hate groups, that innate pull toward empathy turns out to be a powerful antidote to extremist hate. Just as the search for belonging brought Arno into white supremacy, finding that sense of belonging elsewhere was what helped him escape. First, Arno became a dad. He had met a woman named Cassandra. Cassandra was one of the original Chicago area skinheads, which was the first white power crew in the country, Arno explains. She looked like Scarlett Johansson. She was absolutely fucking drop-dead gorgeous, and I was just like, whoa. Apparently, more than whoa was exchanged between them, and a year later, their daughter was born. They named her Mia, the Nordic spelling of Mia, a proper Aryan name. But soon, Cassandra had addiction problems. She and Arno split, and he got custody of Mia. Suddenly, he was a single father. And then a close friend of Arno's in the neo-Nazi movement went to prison, and another was shot and killed. Especially as a new father, those events left Arno jolted and questioning the life he was leading. So he started searching for a new life. I left the movement in 1994, Arno tells me. And by 1996, I was in a filthy, dilapidated warehouse on the south side of Chicago at 4 in the morning on a Saturday, shaking my ass to house music with 3,000 people of every possible ethnicity, sexual orientation, and gender identification on the earth. And like full of MDMA and fucking loving every second of it. Arno felt accepted. I'm sitting on the floor, spun out of my mind on ecstasy, Arno recalls. There's a woman sitting next to him. We're giving each other back rubs and doing ecstasy stuff, which I guess means the touchy-feely stuff one apparently does when on ecstasy. I wouldn't know. She's holding my arm in her lap and she's going like this on the swastikas, Arno says, caressing his own forearm. She's like, what is that? I'm like, I was a skinhead. I feel really badly about it. She's like, not anymore, are you? I'm like, no, not at all. She's like, oh, okay. And then Arno jerks his head and shoulders back and forth to imitate dancing and makes a techno music douche, douche, douche sound to show that it was that easy. That was all it took. And they went back to dancing. That's how everybody was, Arno says. Gay black people and transgender people and people who I would have attacked on sight, they all accepted me and filled that gap, that hole in my life that the movement left there. And it was so much nicer. There's at least one lesson here. Ecstasy and hot girls are more enjoyable than cheap beer and drunken brawls. I'm not speaking from personal experience myself, but I'm pretty sure this is true. Once I took a step out of this ideological box I'd placed myself in, it became a run, Arno tells me. He ran from his old life and embraced his new one with the same zeal. What about the rest of your social scene? I ask. All of your friends. It was replaced within a year by the rave scene. Being a white supremacist had given Arno a sense of belonging, but it turns out so did raves. And the music was better, the drugs were better, and he liked the people more. Almost as quickly as he'd slipped into the neo-Nazi scene, Arno slipped out and found another place he could belong. These days, Arno's off booze and drugs altogether, and is a practicing Buddhist. Really. If Arno's transformation strikes you as frighteningly, even ridiculously, casual and accidental, I'm right there with you. At first, all it took was the wrong band, and now, just the right party? The control freak in me wants both entering and leaving hateful extremism to be significantly more deliberate, like something involving a roving band of jackboot-clad recruiters who are as easy to identify as their targets and thus easy to distance yourself from or disrupt. Hearing Arno's story makes me think about people I know who've had heroin or crack addictions. You imagine that doesn't happen to normal people, and then you realize a bunch of normal people you know are suffering or even dying. The things we don't think can happen to people like us are often already happening all around us. Activist Michael Skolnick made this point about white supremacists in the aftermath of a pro-KKK march in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017. White people, it is time for us to have a serious conversation with our families, our friends, past and present, our co-workers, college roommates, high school classmates, sports teammates, our neighbors, our church congregations and youth groups, our fraternity brothers and sorority sisters. What he means is that it's not those people who are participating in these most explicit and extreme forms of hate. It's our people, and sometimes us. We have to help lead the way out. For Christian Piccolini, another member of the Life After Hate organization, his mindset started changing when he opened a record store that sold white power music, but also punk and ska and metal too. Suddenly, he was interacting with a wider range of people. They were black people and Jewish people and gay people and Hispanic people, Christian says about his customers. I couldn't deny the fact that I started to bond with them over things like music and the neighborhood. It was through music that Megan Phelps Roper and Julicious bonded too. As for Angela King, her life changed when she was convicted of robbing that Jewish-owned store and met black and Latino women in prison. I was shown kindness and compassion from people I felt I least deserved it from, Angela tells me. I was disarmed by their kindness. I had no idea what to do with it. And for Tony McLear, like Arno, a big part of his transformation was becoming a parent. Tony recalls feeling safe to love again because it's safe to love a child. They can't reject you, he says. They can't shame you. Our innate desire for belonging can be harnessed for bad or good, for altruism or hate. Belonging to a family, belonging to a compassionate community, even belonging to a hopped-up mess of techno dancers can lead to inclusion and equity and justice just as much as the desire to belong can lead to hate. This is where connection spaces are important, creating opportunities for us to get out of our proverbial bubbles, either accidentally or deliberately. But to be clear, connecting over our essential human sameness doesn't mean ignoring or papering over the differences between us. Just like the hometowns we come from and the sports teams we root for, our gender and sexuality and ethnicity are important and valuable parts of our identities. For example, some conservatives like to suggest that even acknowledging racial classifications, say, for purposes of pointing out inequity and proposing solutions, is tantamount to racism. Yet sociologists like Eduardo Bonilla Silva, author of Racism Without Racists, argues that the idea of colorblindness functions as an ideology that actually makes us blind to the less visible but still insidious forms of bias in ourselves and the institutions around us. Remember that in Rebecca Bigler's study of elementary school kids, it wasn't just wearing the blue t-shirts or yellow t-shirts that created biases, but the fact that the kids were treated differently because of their t-shirt colors. Now imagine that the differences aren't shirts you can take on and off, but rather skin color, with all the history and habits of either privilege or discrimination inextricably woven in, such that the kids with dark skin get treated differently than the kids with light skin. Is the answer to ignore the problem? If, for instance, the teachers are treating kids differently because of their society-imbued identities, how can we solve that if we're not even supposed to talk about those identities? As Justice Harry Blackmun wrote in a 1978 Supreme Court ruling upholding affirmative action, in order to get beyond racism, we must first take account of race there is no other way. Connection spaces must be used to facilitate thinking that helps us identify and thus start to unravel patterns in our discriminatory perceptions from which discriminatory treatment flows. We can understand and respect each other's differences while simultaneously recognizing our common humanity. Which in a nutshell is what Muzaffar Sherif found in the final stage of his Robbers Cave experiment. Recall that during the first week at the camp, the two groups bonded and formed distinctive group identities as the Rattlers and the Eagles. When they learned about each other, they were eager to compete. And when Sheriff pitted them against one another in various games, such as tug of war, and offered them prizes, they went on the warpath. But in the third and final week of the study, Sheriff changed the terms of their situation yet again. And just as easily as he had artificially created us-them distinctions, fierce competition, and even hatred, Sheriff then made all of that no longer matter. All it took was a few shared experiences, situations that forced them to work together to solve problems. At first, Sheriff and his team blocked a pipe so suddenly that both the Rattlers and the Eagles had a water shortage they had to solve. The next day, the staff said they could rent a movie to watch, but only if all the campers could help pay for it. Then, en route to an overnight camping trip, one of the vans broke down. The kids all pitched in to fix the van, and the next day, when it broke down again, all agreed they could share a van for the rest of the trip. By the last night of camp, the boys were sitting all mixed together with no regard for rattlerdom and eagleness. Sheriff, who had been conducting opinion polls of the boys throughout the study, found that overwhelmingly hostile sentiments about the others had been replaced by overwhelmingly positive feelings. After camp ended, on the ride back to Oklahoma City, the van stopped for snacks. The Rattlers, who had extra prize money from their contest victories, spent it to buy malts for themselves and the Eagles. Of course, real life is infinitely more complex than a situation of a group of boys sequestered at a summer camp for a few weeks. But like those boys, we can use our instincts to form and bond with in-groups, to fan resentment and hate toward out-groups, or to broaden our sense of in-groups, redefine and expand our circles of moral inclusion, and ignite mutual understanding and empathy. Incidentally, Arno Michaelis still thinks of himself as white. He didn't disguise or ignore his identity. He just stopped being a white supremacist. Our identities aren't the problem. The choices we make around those identities, the meanings that we and society give them, that's the problem. Arno made one choice for one part of his life, and then changed his mind and made a different choice. We can also make different choices and turn away from hate. We've mostly been talking about explicit, conscious hatred, the kind embraced by overt white supremacists. As I've said, though, my definition of hate is much broader and includes unconscious bias, too. Perhaps it's obvious that explicit hate isn't inevitable. We've thankfully seen it wane at times in our history. But unconscious bias and hate seem harder to solve, in part because they're more pervasive and because, by definition, we may not even be aware of them. How should we think about and address the hate that we may not even know we have? Chapter 4. Unconscious Hate, the Trump Supporter. If you love peace, then hate injustice, hate tyranny, hate greed, but hate these things in yourself, not in another. Mahatma Gandhi. It would be comforting to think that the only kind of hate in the world is the conscious, explicit sort we see in overt white supremacists. Then we'd know exactly what we were up against and could target it equally explicitly, like publicly calling out neo-Nazis when they march in the streets. Something a lot of people, though not Donald Trump, were quick to do after the Charlottesville demonstrations and violence in 2017. We've been recently reminded that there are plenty of carbon copies of the old Arno Michaelis, plus more modern mainstream versions, like the so-called alt-right, and that many political leaders and organizations in the U.S. still openly express explicit hate toward immigrants and Muslims and transgender people. But in a country literally built on the enslavement of black people, which later instituted segregation policies and condoned lynching, overt hatred is thankfully not as widely socially acceptable, nor politically embraced, today as it once was. That's why so many white Americans have been surprised by the recent surge in white supremacy. Let me be clear. I believe that most Americans today really don't consciously subscribe to racism or most other overtly bigoted beliefs. Even still, African Americans are incarcerated at 5 times the rate of whites and receive harsher sentences for the same crimes. Women earn less than what men earn for the same work. LGBT youth are disproportionately more likely to be homeless. Unemployment rates for Black and Latino Americans are almost double those for whites. If we're no longer, by and large, overtly bigoted, how do these blatant injustices persist? A large body of research assigns some of the blame to our unconscious biases, or, as the academic community calls them, implicit biases, the attitudes and misperceptions that are baked into our minds due to systemic racism and pervasive stereotyping across society. As products of a sexist society, we all have a bias in favor of men and masculinity and against women and femininity. As products of a racist society, we all have a bias for white people and against people of color. As products of a classist society, we all have a bias for rich people and against poor people, and so on. We don't consciously hold these beliefs. They're like deep-down reflexes we've habituated to over time. They're encoded in our brains, and in turn, they play out in ways that then reinforce society-wide bias. Writing about persistent racial inequalities, sociologist Eduardo Bonilla Silva observes, "The main problem nowadays is not the folks with the hoods, but the folks dressed in suits. The more we assume that the problem of racism is limited to the Klan, the birthers, the Tea Party, or to the Republican Party, the less we understand that racial domination is a collective process, and we are all in this game." Systemic racism, though, can be hard for white folks to see, because it's not targeted at them, and we don't talk about it as a society. As Bonilla Silva points out, while most whites believe that racism is synonymous with overt or explicit prejudicial thinking or action, for people of color, racism is systemic or institutionalized. Communities of color live out the myriad effects of systemic racism on a daily basis. Many of us who are white don't acknowledge the realities of systemic bias, partly because we don't really understand the experiences and perspectives of those communities we're biased against, and partly because we don't want to. It can be unpleasant to admit our own biases. Also, some people use overt bias to argue that implicit incarnations aren't the problem. As if to say, see that inequality you're complaining about? It's that really racist guy's fault, not mine. Doing so makes us feel better about ourselves. At least we're not as bad as that guy. But the fact that blatant racism persists doesn't negate the fact that unconscious bias is real and widespread, or that our social and political institutions are warped by it. Is it appropriate to call implicit bias a form of hate? Yes, I argue that it is. Hate doesn't have to be conscious. Actually saying out loud that women are inferior to men and should be treated as such is clearly hateful. But what if you just think it, but don't say it? Or what if you think it, but don't realize you think it? Is that just as hateful? Certainly all of these biases are rooted in the same history and habits of hate in our society, and certainly they all in turn shape our attitudes and behaviors and the world around us. It's not all the same kind of hate, or even as awful. But still, unconscious bias is hate. In making this argument, Bonilla Silva and I have an unusual ally. My friend, Tea Party activist and prominent Trump supporter, Scotty Nell Hughes. "How do you define racism?" I asked Scotty Nell one night over dinner in California where we're speaking together at a conference. "Hatred," she replies easily. "Say more." Racism, it's valuing one person's life over another because of a physical feature or preference, Scotty Nell explains. "Consciously or unconsciously?" I ask. "Does it have to be conscious?" "I think it's both," Scotty Nell answers. "I think hate can be unconscious." Here we agree. But then things get tricky. Acknowledging that some people subconsciously hate others is one thing, but admitting that some people includes ourselves is harder. Maybe it's because I'm particularly self-deprecating that I have less difficulty admitting that I personally have unconscious hate, and that over time I've learned to notice it in my perceptions and actions. That's where Scotty Nell and I diverge. While Scotty Nell agrees that unconscious bias is real and that it constitutes hate, she doesn't necessarily agree that everyone is biased. Certainly, she doesn't think that she is biased. Scotty Nell was one of the most prominent Trump supporters in the news media during the 2016 election as an on-air commentator and colleague of mine on CNN. I first met her at the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, in 2012, when I was still at Fox News. I'd been invited to speak at some side event, and I went because I'd always been curious about the annual gathering of what I considered the presentable right, the strong right-leaning part of the conservative movement that wear bow ties and work in think tanks. Like a lot of political conferences, CPAC sets up a media row in a big room with booth after booth of the usual suspects. As I was strolling the hall, I heard a squeal in my direction. It was Scotty Nell Hughes. She ran over from the Tea Party News Network, where she was news director at the time, to say hello. We'd been on air a few times together at Fox, but never in the same room, so this was our first chance to meet in person. We exchanged hugs and pleasantries and took a selfie. I remember Scotty Nell defending me to a handful of other conference-goers who were leaning away from me like I was poison. Since appearing on CNN seemingly every other day or more during the 2016 elections, often debating Scotty Nell or other Trump supporters like Kayleigh McEnany, Jeffrey Lord, and Betsy McCoy, strangers on the street constantly come up to me and ask how I stop myself from punching them in the face. The honest answer is, I've never wanted to. Sure, I'll admit that once or twice, or maybe six dozen times, I've wanted to scream at them, like when Scotty Nell said that it was sexist of Hillary Clinton to say that she's showing little girls they can grow up to be president, too. Clinton, according to Scotty Nell, was trying to tear down boys in order to build up girls. At which point, every nerve ending in my body wanted to ring out, "Dear God in heaven, are you fucking kidding me? Hillary makes one tiny comment alluding to 270-plus years of institutional inequity, and for that you want to call her sexist?" But I didn't say that, nor did I hit Scotty Nell. Although I did hold hands on camera with my fellow panelist, writer and activist Michaela Angela Davis, as both of us tried desperately to keep our composure. Scotty Nell Hughes doesn't think she's being sexist, nor that Donald Trump is sexist. But Hillary Clinton is? Seriously? In fact, as Hillary Clinton told CNN's Fareed Zakaria in the wake of the 2016 election, "I think sexism and misogyny are endemic in our society." She would probably say everyone is guilty of gender bias to some extent. And she'd be right. By comparison, during her first presidential debate, NBC's Lester Holt asked her, "Do you believe that police are implicitly biased against black people?" Hillary Clinton answered, "Implicit bias is a problem for everyone, not just police. I think, unfortunately, too many of us in our great country jump to conclusions about each other. And therefore, I think we need all of us to be asking hard questions about, you know, why am I feeling this way?" Clinton also said, "We've got to address systemic racism in our criminal justice system." The right wing exploded. Days later, Donald Trump said that Clinton was suggesting that everyone, including our police, are basically racist and prejudiced. Then vice presidential candidate Mike Pence, in his own debate comments, laid into Clinton. Enough of this seeking every opportunity to demean law enforcement broadly by making the accusation of implicit bias whenever tragedy happens, Pence fumed. Pence went on to note that some of the shootings of unarmed blacks were by black officers. His implication was that disproportionate police violence against the black community can't be due to implicit racial bias because black cops do it too. But Pence is wrong on this. Everyone is biased. There's way too much research on implicit bias to deny its existence, conservative columnist William Salatin wrote in response to Pence. Implicit bias isn't an accusation. It doesn't mean you're bad. It means you're normal. And because implicit bias is normal people have it. That means black people, too. This is one of the things that white college students have in common with black police officers. They're all biased. Why? Blacks and whites receive the same narratives and images that perpetuate stereotypes of black criminality and flippancy, while synonymizing white culture with American values, writes Theodore R. Johnson, a former Navy commander who is a fellow at the New America think tank. In an article in The Atlantic, Johnson writes about discovering his own implicit anti-black bias as a black man after taking the implicit association test, IAT, the test most commonly used to measure implicit bias. Johnson writes, "My own hidden biases punched me in the gut." As I was eating dinner with Scotty Nell, I thought back to a trip I'd taken with her a year before. It offers a stark reminder of how biases and stereotypes are ingrained in our minds, but how hard it can be for any of us to see them. In October 2016, Scotty Nell and I find ourselves together in Farmville, Virginia. Vice presidential candidates Mike Pence and Tim Kaine are at Longwood University for their one and only debate during the election campaign, and Scotty Nell and I are both there for CNN's coverage. Long before this debate, Farmville played a far more important role in U.S. history. In 1951, black students at Robert Russa Moton High School staged a walkout to protest the intolerable conditions of their segregated school and to challenge segregated education in general, a vestige of Jim Crow laws that persisted in Virginia and nationwide. Ultimately, the Moton High walkout helped lead to Brown versus Board of Education. When the Supreme Court struck down school segregation in 1954, 3/4 of the plaintiffs in the case on which they ruled came from the Moton School. But it wasn't until 1959, and only under federal pressure, that Virginia finally started the process of integration. Prince Edward County, where Farmville is located, didn't want to integrate its public schools, so the county just shut them all down instead. For 5 years, Prince Edward County had no public schools. White kids flocked to all-white private schools that were being created in response to integration. The county's black students crammed into churches and living rooms as volunteers from the community and some teachers from up north tried to give students the education they were missing. It took another Supreme Court case to force the county to reopen its schools in 1964. The school is now a museum, and Scotty, Nell, and I have a little downtime. Side by side, we walk through the halls of the former Robert Rissa Moton High School without speaking. Each room captures a snippet of history with photographs and text that explains what happened then. But the history you can't see in each room, what that space represents, is palpably heavy. We're both trying to read as much of the wall text as we can, taking it all in. After a long while of moving from room to room in silent contemplation, I finally speak. "This is just so awful," I blurt out. "I don't know what else to say, but I want to say something." "Yeah, it really is," Scotty now replies. And then we both take a deep breath at the same time, followed by more silence. Because, really, what more is there to say? Then maybe a minute later, Scotty Nell adds, "But thankfully it wasn't everyone who supported this." "Huh?" I respond. "What do you mean?" "Well, I mean, thankfully, most of the white people thought this was wrong," Scotty Nell says. "It was just some bad apples who supported it." "No, Scotty Nell, it wasn't," I say, trying to sound earnest, but probably sounding as shocked as I feel. "It was most of the white people, the vast, vast majority of the white people, supported and defended segregation." A 1942 poll confirms this. It asked Americans whether, quote, "white students and Negro students should go to the same schools." Only 30% of Americans nationwide said yes. In 1956, the same question was asked, and support for integration still fell below 50%. And that's just the people who were willing to admit it to the pollster. I turn and face Scotty now. "I like to think that if I'd been alive back then, I would have fought against segregation," I say. "But the odds are I wouldn't have. That's just a reflection of the reality of the time that I would have been a product of, just as much as anyone else." "You don't know that," she says, raising her voice and becoming more and more visibly upset. "You don't know what your ancestors thought or what they believed." Clearly, Scotty Nell has never met my racist grandfather, but that's not the point. The point is statistics. I know that the vast majority of white people back then supported segregation, and the odds are I would have been one of them, I say. Not because I'm an evil person, but because that's how hate works. When it's all around us, we soak it in and regurgitate it. In the case of the U.S. in the 1950s, we're talking about explicit, aggressive racism. But the same is true of unconscious bias. "I wish that wasn't true," I say to Scotty Nell, "but it is." This statement about the past seems to bother Scotty Nell in the same way as Hillary Clinton's statement about the present. The implication that it's not just a fraction of white folks who prop up injustice, but somehow all of us. Scotty Nell feels that when I and pretty much everyone on the left use terms like implicit bias, we're really just calling her a racist. I try to never call anyone a racist because the word can be triggering. Another word I try not to use because it, well, triggers people's reactions. Being called racist instantly puts people on the defensive. In 1950s Virginia, the term was certainly widely called for. And even now, colloquially, we tend to think racist refers to someone who is a deliberate, explicit bigot. Let me say for the record that I don't think Scotty Nell Hughes is a deliberate, explicit bigot. And I don't think the vast majority of Americans, right, left, and center, are deliberate, explicit bigots. But I do think all of us need to come to terms with the fact that we all hold unconscious ideas about the superiority of some groups and the inferiority of others. Ideas that may not be expressed like they were in 1950s Virginia, but that come from that same history and hateful legacy. And when I say all of us, I really do mean everyone, myself included, and you too. Some brilliant work in neuroscience has explained why. Jennifer Kubota, a professor of neuroscience at the University of Chicago, has focused her research on implicit bias in the brain. Kubota explains to me how stereotypes are encoded in our brains. In particular, Kubota points to the little structure deep in the brain called the amygdala. It's composed of two dense clusters of nuclei, one on each side of the center of the brain, each cluster shaped roughly like an almond. Amygdala is Latin for almond. While the amygdala has sometimes been characterized as the brain's emotion center, and often more specifically as the fear center, that's not quite right. The amygdala doesn't itself generate feelings, Kubota clarifies, and there's no one center of emotion. Rather, she explains, the amygdala is involved in learning about important or threatening or novel things in our environment. And then, when we need it, the amygdala quickly recalls what's been learned so that we can just as quickly evaluate whatever situation we're in and respond accordingly. Think of the amygdala like an efficient filing cabinet for everything society has taught us that our brains have absorbed. The amygdala takes in whatever messages are around it, including the endemic racial stereotypes that percolate through the media and our education practices and our families and every other single aspect of our existence. So, for instance, if Kubota asks a diverse class of freshmen to list the stereotypes about women in the United States, she says, it's pretty remarkable how much consensus you'll get. Everyone can regurgitate the same narrative, even if they don't personally believe that. That associative information is kind of stuck in the system. And the women in the class know the stereotypes as well as the men. In other words, biases are stuck in society's system and, in turn, get stuck in all of our brains, particularly in our tiny almonds. The amygdala doesn't mean to be hateful. It learns to hate from a hateful society. The unconscious makes associations based on frequency, explains John A. Powell, a law professor at the University of California, Berkeley, who has extensively studied the research on implicit bias. So, for instance, because the news overreports black crime, at an unconscious level, explains Powell, we'll create a neural linkage between crime and black. Whether or not we even personally, consciously believe black people are more or less likely to commit crime. Implicit biases are like projections of society's biases etched into our unconscious. And it happens to all of us. It's the air that we breathe, says Powell. You breathe that until you're an adult, you're going to have those associations. Whites will have them, blacks will have them, Latinos will have them. Those associations have shown up clearly in brain studies. Most brain research nowadays is done using functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI. Blood activity in the brain is scanned, using MRI technology, to measure degrees of brain activity prompted by various stimuli, such as looking at photos. The functional part is that it happens in real time. In other words, researchers will say or do something to subjects and watch the subject's brains light up according to which parts are involved in processing the given information. The more a part of the brain lights up, the more actively engaged that part is. New York University neuroscientist Elizabeth Phelps and her research team conducted an important study in 2000 that identified the neural signature of negative stereotypes. They built on earlier work that found that the amygdala is activated more when subjects are shown photos of people with fearful facial expressions than when they are presented with photos of people with neutral expressions. This detection of danger, in turn helping trigger fear, is one of the most well-established functions of the amygdala. And neuroscientists have long believed that greater amygdala activation is due to a greater perceived threat. Phelps' study followed this same basic procedure, but with a twist. Her team hooked subjects up to an fMRI machine and then flashed random yearbook photos of white people and black people, all of whom had neutral facial expressions. None were fearful. The results? The majority of white subjects, Phelps reported, showed greater amygdala activation when viewing unfamiliar black compared to white faces. In other words, seeing unfamiliar neutral black faces triggered fear. Phelps and her team then compared the same people's amygdala activation to their scores on an implicit bias assessment, which they'd taken before the fMRI study. They found that the more implicit bias people had, the more their amygdala lit up. Her team also used another common measure of unconscious fear to evaluate the white subjects' reactions to the two sets of faces. Called the startle response, it looks at the magnitude of a person's eye blink reflex, which is another indicator of fear. The people with higher implicit bias and higher amygdala activity also had more intense startle responses. How did scientists interpret those results? Their conclusion was that greater amygdala activity indicated that subjects perceived a threat when viewing the black faces. A wealth of subsequent fMRI studies have produced similar evidence of implicit anti-black bias. And as Elizabeth Phelps and her colleagues sum up the findings, work on measures of implicit biases has shown that they are pervasive and robust. A great deal of research has revealed the pernicious effects of implicit bias in people's lives. As John A. Powell and a group of other researchers write in a comprehensive report that summarized this work, titled The Science of Equality, studies have shown that bias is operating in our schools, our business offices, our medical institutions, and, yes, as Hillary Clinton said, in our criminal justice system. In the case of medical treatment, studies have revealed that white doctors spend less time on average with black patients, discuss their conditions with them less fully, involve them less in decision-making about their treatment, and exhibit bias in referring them for procedures and treatments and prescribing medications to them. For instance, one study showed that black patients who reported chest pain were 40% less likely than white patients to be referred for cardiac catheterization, a standard procedure for measuring heart function. Other studies have shown that black patients are systemically undertreated for pain relative to white patients. One of these studies, which examined an extraordinary 60 million cases of pain medication prescriptions written for patients between 2007 and 2011, found that a black patient with the same level of pain and everything else being accounted for, meaning factors such as age, socioeconomic level, and type of insurance, was much less likely to receive an opioid prescription than a white patient with the same characteristics. There are equally troubling findings regarding bias in the criminal justice system. One study, published by Stanford Law School professor Jennifer Eberhardt and her colleagues, found that defendants whose appearance was more stereotypically black, i.e. darker skinned, with a broader nose and thicker lips, were sentenced more harshly, and in particular were more likely to be sentenced to death than if their features were less stereotypically black. The authors explain a growing body of research demonstrates that people more readily apply racial stereotypes to blacks who are thought to look more stereotypically black, and that the more stereotypically black a person's physical traits appear to be, the more criminal that person is perceived to be. Concerning biases and interactions between police officers and people they stop, another Stanford study made use of footage from police body cameras. The researchers found that officers on average spoke less respectfully to black residents than their white counterparts, meaning that they were less likely to be addressed with a formal greeting. Titles such as sir or ma'am were infrequent, sharp commands were more common, and apologies or expressions of gratitude were rare. They conclude that the issue is not overt expressions of racism. It is believed that many times the officers simply do not realize that their words sometimes harm those on the receiving end, who must then determine whether they are the subject of a racist police confrontation. In studies of classroom interactions between teachers and students, researchers have found that teachers tend to devote less attention to black students and ask them fewer questions in class, as well as offering them less feedback on their work. As reported by U.S. News and World Report, multiple studies have also shown that in college, professors are less responsive to inquiries from students of color, and implicit bias can influence the grades professors give students whose work is identical. Regarding bias in the workplace, a number of studies have shown that among job applicants with closely comparable skills and experience, white job seekers received 50% more calls for interviews than black and Latino job candidates. In one of these studies, researchers sent in resumes they had written that listed exactly the same set of skills and same job experience to over 1,300 advertisements for jobs. The only differentiating feature of the resumes was that half of the ostensible applicants had stereotypically black names, such as Lakeisha Washington, and half had stereotypically white names, such as Susan Baker. The resumes with the white names received 50% more callbacks for interviews. We might expect that some of this bias was actually explicit, but in the main, the researchers assert that the stereotyping of blacks was unconscious. Often unconscious bias can be hard to point out, let alone measure. But anecdotally, there are glaring examples. In 2016, when African-American high school student Adia Brown entered the room at her school in Denver, where she was to take the ACT exam, the proctor, who had never met her and knew nothing about her academic background, told her, "Special education students are tested down the hall." Also in 2016, African-American OBGYN Tamika Cross was on a Delta Airlines flight when a passenger fell ill. When Cross went to help the passenger, the crew wouldn't allow her to, because they did not believe she was a doctor. After Cross wrote about the incident on Facebook, the hashtag What a Doctor Looks Like was started in response, with multitudes of women doctors of color posting photos of themselves in their medical uniforms. I could write about countless more such experiences of bias, including the subtle acts of discrimination and mistreatment, often called microaggressions, which may be genuinely unconscious to those who commit them, but are acutely observed by those they're directed against and have a profound impact on those individuals and our society. As John Powell and his colleagues write, they are replicated in everyday micro-behaviors demonstrating that race affects social perception, such as the clutched purse when a black man enters the elevator, the assumption that a black lawyer works in the mailroom or as a secretary. Thinking that finding a way to specifically measure implicit bias would support better research and documentation and raise public awareness about the problem, psychologists Anthony Greenwald and Mazarin Banaji created the Implicit Association Test, IAT, in 1998. You can take the IAT for free on the website of Project Implicit, which Banaji and Greenwald run. I did, and I found the design of the test ingenious. The basic procedure is that you're asked to respond to a series of words or pictures flashed on a screen, and the computer measures how quickly you make associations between them. The theory behind the test is that the more quickly we're able to match concepts, the more closely those concepts must be associated in our minds. For instance, we'll associate ball and tennis more quickly than ball and checkers. That's not because ball and checkers can't be associated. They are, after all, both games. But the association between ball and tennis is, for most people, stronger, and therefore happens more quickly in our minds. The idea at the core of the IAT is that the speed with which we make these unconscious associations can be measured and then compared to determine relative bias. So, for instance, the racial bias IAT has you use computer keys to sort pictures of faces as being either white or black. Then you use the keys to sort words like excellent and joy and nasty and hate as either good or bad. Then comes the real test. The computer flashes pictures of faces along with either positive or negative words, such as a white face with the word nasty and a black face with the word excellent, and you have to sort them into one of two categories, white and bad or black and good. The results from more than 2 million test takers show that people of all races tend to more quickly make associations between white and good and between black and bad. In the end, the test gives takers a score, ranging from having little to no automatic preference for white people compared to black people, to a slight, moderate, or strong preference. Greenwald, Banaji, and their colleagues have since created IAT tests that also attempt to measure bias around gender, sexuality, religion, and more, all of which are available to take on the website. The reality of implicit bias was understood by the scholarly community well before the creation of the IAT, but this innovative way to measure implicit bias led to an explosion of new research and public debate. The American Psychological Society's magazine called the IAT a revolution in social psychology, and Malcolm Gladwell, in his best-selling book Blink, wrote, "The IAT is more than just an abstract measure of attitudes. It's a powerful predictor of how we act in certain kinds of spontaneous situations." Yet the IAT has been criticized by some researchers and scientific journalists. The arguments aren't about whether implicit bias is a real phenomenon. On that, there's broad agreement. Even Hart Blanton, a social psychologist at the University of Connecticut who is one of the leading critics of the IAT, told a reporter for Wired magazine, "In general, researchers are comfortable with the idea implicit bias is a problem and word needs to get out." Rather, critics argue that the IAT is not accurate enough for a person's score to be considered a reliable predictor of the way people think and behave. Critics point out that people may in fact end up with different scores if they take the test multiple times. Anthony Greenwald and Mazarin Banaji have actually conceded that the test isn't that sort of precise diagnostic, and they caution on the Project Implicit website that people should not consider their scores a firm indication that they necessarily act in biased ways. They say the test should instead be considered a tool for becoming generally more aware of the negative stereotyping that has made its way into all of our minds to some degree. And I'll vouch for it being quite revelatory in that sense. It was for me. I think that's the vital point about implicit bias that has been obscured by the controversy. The whole point is to just be more self-aware, and that doing so can actually help counter any bias. As neuroscientist Jennifer Kubota stresses, implicit bias absolutely does not have to dictate our behavior. If we are acting with bias, becoming aware of the problem allows us to consciously work to counter that. A group of researchers studied the effects of what they called a prejudice habit-breaking intervention that involves teaching people about their implicit racial bias. And the results were that people who received the intervention showed dramatic reductions in their bias. I believe the IAT can do a world of good by helping people simply see what are otherwise hard-to-see biases. For what it's worth, Arno Michaelis, Scotty Nell Hughes, and I all took the race IAT. And we all showed a preference for white people over black people. During my dinner with her in California, as we polished off a plate of cheese and tomatoes, Scotty Nell tells me, "You're wanting change by only focusing on the negatives." "No," I say, "I don't think it's a negative to acknowledge my own bias." "What are you biased against?" Scotty Nell asks, putting her fork down and staring incredulously at me. "I'm biased against the same exact things we all are," I answer. "What?" Scotty Nell presses. "Well, I'm biased in favor of men against women," I say. This statement is just too much for Scotty Nell to take, especially because of the whole me being a lesbian thing, I think. "Wait a minute, you're in favor of men?" she half says, half laughs. "Yeah," I say. At this point, the waitress interrupts to see if we want dessert. "No, of course we don't want dessert. We're two women on television, both overly concerned about our weight. And also, we're finally getting somewhere in this conversation." "You mean to tell me you're biased? You're sexist?" Scotty Nell asks again when the waitress leaves. "Obviously, of course I am. I regularly assume that men are more qualified and knowledgeable on subjects than women are. I often wonder how my female colleagues got their jobs, but don't even think to question the credentials of male colleagues. I try to notice it and catch myself and counteract it, but those biases are there. Not to mention the fact that I'm a butch lesbian who dresses in men's clothing and ostensibly benefits from masculine power and privilege because of how I present in the world." But I didn't think Scotty Nell was quite ready for that level of reflection. So I brought up a different example of my own bias. "I live in a neighborhood that's segregated block by block, but is fairly racially diverse," I tell Scotty Nell. "According to U.S. Census Bureau data, New York City is the second most diverse city in the nation, after San Jose, California, and my zip code is in the top quartile of the most diverse in the city." "I'll tell you, I mean, I catch myself doing it and I try not to," I say to Scotty Nell, "but if I see a white person in a Mercedes, I don't even think about it. I just assume they're a doctor or a lawyer or whatever. I just assume they're rich. But if I see a black person driving a Mercedes, I notice it. And I wonder why they have that car." That's bias. My bias. I could try to explain that away as my psyche merely absorbing the statistical patterns of the racial wealth gap, and to some extent that might be true. There are definitely more rich white people in the United States and in New York City, and therefore more rich white people likely to be driving a Mercedes. But what my unconscious is doing, when unchecked, is applying that assumption to every case, even when it's completely unjustified or, in fact, discriminatory. I'm not even assuming that 10 or 5 or even 3% of the black people with a Mercedes are doctors. If I'm being honest, I'm wondering almost 100% of the time if they're drug dealers. That's bias. It's the same bias that made the people on the Delta flight not believe that the black OBGYN was really a doctor. In other words, in response to Scotty Nell's question, yes, when I say everyone is biased, I'm definitely including myself. Because I grew up in a nation where the news media disproportionately reports on black crime and portrays black people accused of crimes as more sinister. Those biases are inscribed on my unconscious. I inherently believe boys are better at science and more aggressive, that girls are sensitive and more creative, also because of society's patterns and messages, all of which in turn are regurgitated and replicated in my attitudes and assumptions and actions, unless I do something about it. This is where fault and responsibility become complicated. I don't think it's my fault that the United States has a racist, sexist, hate-filled history. But I do think it's my responsibility to do something about it. It's here that my conversation with Scotty Nell breaks down again. And again, I think back to that trip in Farmville in the fall of 2016. Scotty Nell had brought up a story about when she was a freshman in college at the University of Tennessee at Martin in the late 1990s. There was a new program to pair white freshmen with black freshmen as roommates, which we both agree was a good thing. Coming from a small rural white town, Scotty Nell said she was excited to expand her horizons. But as Scotty Nell told the story, even though her black roommate and she came from similar working class backgrounds, Scotty Nell had to work two jobs during college to pay her bills while her roommate got a full scholarship. And, Scotty Nell said, that wasn't fair. I responded, you're assuming she got a scholarship because she's black, and that's why you feel resentful. Scotty Nell agreed. Yeah, she said, as if the point was blazingly obvious. Of course that's why she got the scholarship. But how did she know the award wasn't based on her